Lorna took her friend to the hospital, and when they put the cast on her arm and had set her nose, they set it almost straight, Lorna took Melanie back to the women-only boarding house, where they both agreed they belonged, together. Lorna moved her things back in while Melanie was convalescing. The swelling in her face went down after a few days, and her eyes turned from black to a purplish-green to yellow in about a week. "The thing is," Melanie said, with her sore face against Lorna's tummy, with Lorna's hand stroking her hair, "when he was a boy, he had that kind of bravery that's really special. No one could make him just go along with what was going on. And now look at him, banging a cripple's wife, lying to his own son."
"It's disgusting," Lorna agreed.
"Why not forget it?"
When Melanie didn't answer her, Lorna asked, "How come you're not going to press charges against Bob?"
"Suppose it works?" Melanie asked.
"Pardon me?" Lorna said.
"Suppose they really put Bob in jail or send him off somewheres?" Melanie asked.
"Then when I'm all better, I won't be able to find him."
"Oh," Lorna said. Homer Wells did not recognize the voice that spoke to him from the headlight's glare.
"What you got in the bag, Homer?" asked Mr. Rose.
It had been a long drive from the Carolinas, and Mr. Rose's old car creaked and popped with heat and with apparent pain.
"It's nice of you working all night to make my house nice for me, Homer," he said.
When he stepped in front of his headlights, his black face was still hard to see, but Homer recognized the way he moved, so slowly, but with a felt potential for moving so fast.
"Mr. Rose," Homer said.
"Mr. Wells," said Mr. Rose, smiling.
They shook hands while Homer's heart calmed down. Candy was still hiding in the cider house, and Mr. Rose sensed that Homer wasn't alone. He was peering through the lit kitchen, looking into the shadowy bunk room, when Candy walked, guiltily, into the light.
"Mrs. Worthington," said Mr. Rose.
"Mr. Rose," Candy said, smiling, shaking his hand.
"We're just in time," she said to Homer, poking him. "We just this minute got all the bed linen ready," she told Mr. Rose,
but Mr. Rose observed that there was no car or truck, that they had walked to the cider house. Had they carried all the blankets and sheets?
"Just this minute we got it all folded up, I mean," Candy said.
Homer Wells thought that Mr. Rose might have seen the light in the Apple Mart office when he drove by.
"We were working late in the office," Homer said, "and we remembered the linen was down here, all in a heap."
Mr. Rose nodded and smiled.
"Then the baby cried."
Candy jumped.
"I wrote to Wally about bringing the daughter,"
Mr. Rose explained, as a young woman about Angel's age walked into the light with a baby in her arms.
"I haven't seen you since you were a little girl," Homer Wells told the young woman, who looked at him blankly.
It must have been an exhausting trip with a small child.
"My daughter," Mr. Rose said in introduction. "And her daughter," he added. "Mrs. Worthington," said Mr. Rose, introducing her, "and Homer Wells."
"Candy," Candy said, shaking the young woman's hand.
"Homer," Homer said. He couldn't remember the daughter's name, and so he asked her. She looked a little startled and looked at her father, as if for clarification or advice.
"Rose," Mr. Rose said.
Everyone laughed, the daughter too. The baby stopped crying and looked with wonder at the laughter.
"No, I mean your first name," said Homer Wells.
"Rose is her first name," said Mr. Rose. "You already heard it."
"Rose Rose?" Candy asked.
The daughter smiled. She didn't look very sure.
"Rose Rose," said Mr. Rose proudly.
Everyone laughed again. The baby was cheering up, and Candy played with the little girl's fingers.
"What's her name?"
Candy asked Rose Rose. This time the young woman answered for herself.
"She don't have a name yet," Rose Rose replied.
"We're still thinking it out," said Mr. Rose.
"What a good idea," said Homer Wells, who knew that too many names were given frivolously, or just temporarily, or in the cases of John Wilbur and Wilbur Walsh, that they were repeated without imagination. "The cider house isn't really set up for a baby," Candy said to Rose Rose. "If you'd like to come up to the house, I may have some baby things you could use. There's even a playpen in the attic, isn't there, Homer?"
"We don't need nothing," Mr. Rose said pleasantly. "Maybe she'll look another day."
"I could sleep a whole day, I think," said Rose Rose, prettily.
"If you'd like," Candy told her, "I could look after the baby for you, so you could sleep."
"We don't need nothing," Mr. Rose repeated. "Not today, anyway," he said, smiling.
"Want a hand unpacking?" Homer asked him.
"Not today, anyway," Mr. Rose said.
"What's in the bag, Homer?" he asked, when they'd all said good night and Homer and Candy were leaving.
"Apples," Homer admitted.
"That would be strange," said Mr. Rose. Homer unzipped the bag and showed him the apples.
"You the apple doctor?"
Mr. Rose asked him.
Homer almost said, "Right."
"He knows," Homer said to Candy, as they were walking back to the office.
"Of course he knows," Candy said. "But what's it matter if we're stopping?"
"I guess it doesn't matter," Homer said.
"Since you were prepared to tell Wally and Angel," she said, "I guess it won't be that hard to really do it."
"After the harvest," he said. He took her hand, but when they came near the apple mart and the office light, they dropped hands and walked their separate ways.
"What's the bag for?" Candy asked him, before she kissed him good night.
"It's for me," said Homer Wells. "I think it's for me."
He fell asleep, marveling at what seemed to him to be the extreme control Mr. Rose had of his world. He even controlled the speed at which his daughter's daughter would be named, not to mention, probably, the name itself. Homer woke up near dawn and took a fountain pen from his night table and used it to write, with a heavy finality, over the penciled number on the back of the photograph of the crew of Opportunity Knox. With the dark ink, he followed the outline of the pencil. This permanency was reassuring, as if ink, as on a contract, was more binding than pencil. He couldn't have known that Candy was also awake. Her stomach was upset, and she was looking for some medicine in her and Wally's bathroom. She also found it necessary to address the subject of the 270 times she and Homer had made love together since Wally had come home from the war. But Candy honored the finality of this number with less significance than Homer honored it. Instead of writing over the number in ink, Candy used her eraser to remove the evidence from the back of the photograph of her teaching Homer how to swim. Then her stomach calmed, and she was able to sleep. It astonished her how completely relaxed she was at the prospect that after the harvest, her life, as she'd grown used to it, would be over. Homer Wells didn't try to go back to sleep. He knew his history on the subject of sleep. He knew there was no fighting history. He read an article in the New England Journal of Medicine about antibiotic therapy. He'd followed, for many years, the uses of penicillin and streptomycin. He was less familiar with oreomycin and terramycin, but he thought that antibiotics were easy to figure out. He read about the limited usage of neomycin. He made note of the fact that acromycin and tetracycline were the same. He wrote erythromycin in the margin of the article several times until he was sure he knew how to spell it. Dr. Larch had taught him that method of familiarizing himself with something new. "Erythromycin," wrote Homer Wells. The apple doctor, as Mr. Rose had called him. He wrote that in the margin, too. The apple doctor. And just before he got out of bed, he wrote, "A Bedouin again." In the morning, Candy sent Angel to the cider house to inquire if Rose Rose needed anything for the baby, and that was when Angel fell in love. He was shy with girls his own age. Boys his own age and a little older always teased him about his name. He thought he was the only angel in Maine.
He was even shy in advance of meeting girls, anticipating when he would have to tell them his name. In Hart's Rock and Hart's Haven, the prettier, more confident girls in his class ignored him. They were interested in the older boys. Girls who appeared to like him were plain, sullen gossips who most enjoyed talking to other girls like themselves, or about which boys had said what to whom. Every time Angel spoke to a girl, he knew his remarks were relayed that evening over the telephone to every other neglected girl in his class. The following morning they would all smirk at him, as if he'd said the same foolish thing to each of them. And so he learned to keep quiet. He watched the older girls in school. He approved of the ones who did the least amount of talking to their girlfriends. They struck him as more mature, by which he meant that they were actually doing things they would not want their girlfriends to know. In 1950-something, girls Angel's age looked forward to dating. Boys Angel's age, as in other times, looked forward to doing things. Mr. Rose's daughter was not only the most exotic young woman Angel had ever seen. If she had a daughter, she must also have done things. It was cold and damp in the cider house in the mornings. When Angel arrived there, Rose Rose was outside in the sun, washing baby Rose in a bucket. The baby was splashing, and Rose Rose was talking to her daughter. She didn't hear Angel walking up to her. Perhaps, since Angel had been brought up more by his father than by his mother, Angel was predisposed to be attracted to a Madonna scene. Rose Rose was only a few years older than Angel. She was so young that her maternity was startling. When she was with her baby, her gestures and her expressions were womanly, and she had a full womanly figure. She was a little taller than Angel. She had a round, boyish face. "Good morning," Angel said, startling baby Rose in the bucket. Rose Rose wrapped her daughter in a towel and stood up. "You must be Angel," she said shyly. She had a fine scar that sliced across the flange of one nostril and her upper lip. It made a nick in her gum, which Angel could see when she parted her lips. Later, he would see that the knife had stopped at the eye tooth and removed it, which accounted for her only partial smile. She would explain to him that the wound had killed the root of the tooth and that the tooth had fallen out later. He was so smitten when he first met her that even the scar was beautiful to him. It was her only apparent flaw. "I wondered if I could help you get anything for the baby," Angel said. "She seemed to be teething," Rose Rose reported on her daughter. "She kind of cranky today." Mr. Rose came out of the cider house. When he saw Angel, he waved and smiled, and then he walked over and put his arm around the boy. "How you doing?" he asked. "You still growing, I think. I used to carry him on top of my head," he told Rose Rose. "He used to grab them apples I couldn't reach," Mr. Rose explained, punching Angel affectionately on the arm. "I'm counting on growing a little more," Angel said, for Rose Rose's benefit. He wouldn't want her to think he had stopped growing. He wanted her to know that he would be taller than she one day. He wished he'd worn a shirt. It was not that he wasn't muscular, it was somehow more grown up to wear a shirt. Then he imagined that she might approve of his summer tan, and so he relaxed about not having a shirt. He put his hands in the hip pockets of his jeans, and he wished he'd worn his baseball cap. It was a Boston Red Sox cap, and he had to get hold of it first thing in the morning if he was going to wear it. Otherwise, Candy would wear it. They had been meaning to buy another baseball cap for 2 summers now. Candy owed him one because she'd admitted to tearing one of the sweat holes in the cap by poking a pencil through it. Candy worked as a checker during the harvest, and she needed her pencil. This would be the second harvest that Angel would be a checker, and the second summer that he got to drive one of the tractors that hauled the apples out of the orchards. When Angel told his father that Rose Rose's baby was teething, Homer knew what to do. He sent Angel, with Wally, to town to buy some pacifiers, and then he sent Angel back to the cider house with a package of pacifiers and a fifth of bourbon. Wally drank a very little bourbon from time to time, and the bottle was 3/4 full. Homer showed Angel how to dab whiskey on baby Rose's gums. "It numbs the gums," Angel explained to Rose Rose. He dipped his pinky finger in the whiskey, then he stuck his finger in Baby Rose's tiny mouth.
At first he was afraid he'd gag the baby girl, whose eyes instantly grew large and watery at the bourbon fumes. But then Baby Rose went to work on Angel's finger so ferociously that when he removed his finger to apply more bourbon, the baby cried to have the finger back.
"You gonna make her drunk," Rose warned.
"No, I won't," Angel assured her. "I'm just putting her gums to sleep." Rose examined the pacifiers. They were rubber nipples, like the nipple on a baby's bottle, but without the hole and attached to a baby blue plastic ring that was too big to swallow. The problem with using a regular bottle nipple, Angel Wells explained, was that the baby would keep sucking in air through the hole, and the air would give the baby burping fits or a gassy stomach.
"How come you know so much?" Rose asked Angel, smiling.
"How old are you?"
"I'm almost 16," Angel said. "How old are you?"
"About your age," she told him. In the afternoon, when Angel came back to the cider house to see how the teething was going, Baby Rose was not the only Rose with a pacifier stuck in her mouth. Mr. Rose was sitting on the cider house roof, and Angel could see, from a considerable distance because of the unreal baby blue hue of the plastic ring, that he had a pacifier in his mouth.
"Are you teething, too?" Angel called up to him.
Mr. Rose removed the pacifier from his mouth slowly, the way he did everything.
"I'm cutting out smoking," said Mr. Rose. "You got a nipple in your mouth all day. Who needs a cigarette?"
He stuck the pacifier back in his mouth and grinned at Angel broadly. In the cider house, Baby Rose had fallen asleep with a pacifier in her mouth, and Angel surprised Rose as she was washing her hair. She was bent over the kitchen sink with her back to him. He couldn't see her breasts, although she was bare from the waist up.
"Is that you?"
she asked ambiguously, keeping her back turned to him, but not jumping to cover herself.
"Sorry," Angel said, stepping back outside. "I should have knocked."
Then she jumped and covered herself, her hair still soapy. She must have thought it was her father.
"I was checking on how the teething was going," Angel explained.
"It going fine," Rose said. "You a good doctor. You my hero for today." She was smiling her partial smile. A stream of bright suds from the shampoo ran around her neck and down her chest, over her arms, which she'd folded with a towel across her unseen breasts. Angel Wells, smiling, backed so far away from the cider house door that he bumped into the old car, which was parked close enough against the cider house to appear to be helping hold the building up. He heard a tiny pebble come rolling down the cider house roof, but when it hit him on the head, even though he'd had time to steal the baseball cap away from Candy and now wore it at a casual angle, with the visor shading his forehead, the pebble hurt. He looked up at Mr. Rose, who had rolled the pebble in his direction. A perfect shot.
"Gotcha," Mr. Rose said, smiling.
But it was Rose who'd really gotten him. Angel staggered back to the Apple Mart and into the fancy house as if he'd been struck by a boulder.
"Who was the baby's father?" Angel Wells wondered. "And where was he? And where was Mrs. Rose? Were Mr. Rose and his daughter all alone?"
Angel went to his room and began to compose a list of names, girls' names. He took some names he liked out of the dictionary, and then he added other names that the dictionary had overlooked. How else do you impress a girl who hasn't been able to think of a name for her baby? Angel would have been a blessing to St. Cloud's, where the practice of naming the babies was a little worn out. Although Nurse Caroline had contributed her youthful energy to the nearly constant occasion, her rather political choices had been met with some resistance. She was fond of Carl, for Marx, and Eugene, for Debs, but everyone balked at Friedrich, for Engels, and so she'd been reduced to Fred, which she didn't like. Nurse Angela also complained about Norman, for Thomas. To her it was a name like Wilbur. But it was difficult to know if Angel Wells could have kept his passion for names intact when the task was almost a daily business. Finding a name for Rose's daughter was a devotion quite unexpected, yet it was typical of a boy's first love. Abby, thought Angel Wells, Alberta, Alexandra, Amanda, Amelia, Antoinette,
Audrey? Aurora? Aurora Rose, Angel said aloud.
God, no, he said, plunging into the alphabet. The scar on the face of the young woman he loved was so extremely thin, so very fine, Angel imagined that if he could kiss that scar, he could make it disappear, and he began working his way through the B's. Bathsheba, Beatrice, Bernice, Bianca, Blanche, Bridget. Dr. Larch was facing a different problem. The dead patient had come to St. Cloud's without a scrap of identification. She brought only her burning infection, her overpowering discharge, her dead but unexpelled fetus, and several of the instruments she, or someone else, had put into herself in order to expel the fetus, her punctured uterus, her unstoppable fever, her acute peritonitis. She reached Dr. Larch too late for him to save her, yet Larch blamed himself. "She was alive when she got here," Larch told Nurse Caroline. "I'm supposed to be a doctor."
"Then be one," Nurse Caroline said, "and stop being maudlin."
"I'm too old," Larch said. "Someone younger, someone quicker might have saved her."
"If that's what you think, maybe you are too old," Nurse Caroline told him. "You're not seeing things as they are."
"As they are," said Wilbur Larch, who closed himself off in the dispensary. He'd never been good about losing patients, but this one, Nurse Caroline knew, was quite lost when she'd arrived.
"If he can hold himself responsible for a case like that," Nurse Caroline told Nurse Angela, "then I think he ought to be replaced. He is too old."
Nurse Angela agreed.
"It's not that he's incompetent, but once he starts thinking he's incompetent, he's had it."
Nurse Edna would not contribute to this conversation. She went and stood outside the dispensary door, where she repeated and repeated,
"You're not too old. You're not incompetent. You're not too old."
But Wilbur Larch could not hear her. He was under ether, and he was traveling. He was far away, in Burma, which he saw almost as clearly as Wally ever saw it, although Larch, even with ether's assistance, could never have imagined such heat. The shade that he saw under the peepal trees was deceiving. It was not really cool there, not at that time of the day that the Burmese referred to as when feet are silent. Larch was observing the missionary Dr. Stone making his rounds. Even the noonday heat would not keep Fuzzy Stone from saving the diuretic children. Wally could have informed Larch's dream with some better detail. How slippery the bamboo leaves were when one was trying to walk uphill, for example. How the sleeping mats were always damp with sweat. How it seemed, to Wally, to be a country of sub-magistrates, corrupted by the British, either into being like the British or into being consumed by their hatred of the British. Wally had once been carried across a plateau shot through with sprouting weeds and befouled with pig shit. On it was a former tennis court, built by someone British. The net was now a magistrate's hammock. The court itself, because of the high fence that enclosed it, was a good place to keep the pigs. The fence, which had once kept tennis balls from being lost in the jungle, now made it more difficult for the leopards to kill the pigs. At that way station, Wally would remember, the magistrate himself had instrumented his urinary tract for him. A kindly, round-faced man with patient, steady hands, he had used a long silver swizzle stick, something else the British had left behind. Although the magistrate's English was poor, Wally had made him understand what the swizzle stick was for.
"British is crazy," the Burmese gentleman had said to Wally.
"Yes?"
"Yes, I think so," Wally had agreed. He hadn't known many British, but some of them seemed crazy to him, and so it seemed a small thing to agree to, and Wally thought it was wise to agree with whoever it was who held the catheter. The silver swizzle stick was too inflexible for a proper catheter, and the top of the thing was adorned with a kind of heraldic shield, Queen Victoria's stern face presiding. In this one case, she was observing a use of the instrument she adorned that might have shocked her.
"Only British is crazy enough to make something to stir a drink," the magistrate said, chuckling.
He lubricated the catheter with his own saliva. Through his tears, Wally tried to laugh. and in the rounds that Dr. Stone was making, wouldn't many of the diuretic children suffer urinary retention? Wouldn't Dr. Stone have to relieve their little distended bladders? And wouldn't his catheter be proper and his method of instrumentation sound? In Wilbur Larch's eyes, which were over Burma, Dr. Stone would be perfect. Fuzzy Stone wouldn't lose a single patient. Nurse Caroline, understanding that the coincidence of the woman dying without a name would not sit well alongside the recent evidence submitted to the Board of Trustees, knew it was time for her to write to Homer Wells. While Dr. Larch rested in the dispensary, Nurse Caroline worked with a vengeance over the typewriter in Nurse Angela's office. "Don't be a hypocrite," she began. "I hope you recall how vehemently you were always telling me to leave Cape Kenneth, that my services were more needed here, and you were right. And do you think your services aren't needed here, or that they aren't needed right now? Do you think the apples can't grow without you? Just who do you think the board's going to replace him with if you don't step forward? One of the usual cowards who does what he's told, one of your typically careful, mousy medical men, a little law-abiding citizen who will be of absolutely no use." She mailed that letter at the same time she alerted the station master that there was a body at the orphanage. Various authorities would have to be sent for. It had been a long time since the station master had seen bodies at the orphanage, but he would never forget the bodies he had seen. Not his predecessor, after the sternum shears had opened him up, and certainly never the fetal autopsy from Three Mile Falls. "A body?" the station master asked. He gripped the sides of the small table where the constant television revealed to him its blurry, fade-in and fade-out images, any one of which the station master found preferable to the more vivid picture of those long-ago bodies. "Someone who didn't want to have a baby," Nurse Caroline told him. "She butchered herself trying to get the baby out. She got to us too late for us to be able to do anything about it." Unanswering and never taking his eyes from the snowy, zigzagging figures on the TV screen, the station master clung to the table as if it were an altar, and the television was his god. At least, he knew, he would never see on that television anything resembling what Nurse Caroline described, and so the station master continued to watch the TV instead of looking into Nurse Caroline's eyes. Carmen, Cecilia, Charity, Claudia, Constance, Cookie, Cordelia. Angel Wells cocked the Red Sox cap at the correct angle. Although it was cool in the early morning, he elected not to wear a shirt. Dagmar, he thought, Daisy, Dolores, Dottie. "Where are you going in my hat?" Candy asked him. She was picking up the breakfast dishes. "It's my hat," Angel said, going out the door. "Love is blind," Wally said, pushing his wheelchair away from the table. "Does he mean me or Angel?" Candy wondered. Homer and Wally were worried about Angel's puppy-like infatuation with Rose Rose, but that is all it seemed to Candy, puppy-like. Candy knew that Rose Rose had too much experience to allow Angel to get carried away. "That wasn't the point," Homer had said. Candy imagined that Rose Rose had more experience in her little finger than... "But that wasn't the point either," Wally had said. "Well, I hope the point isn't that she's colored," Candy had said. "The point is Mr. Rose," Wally had said. The word "right" had been almost visible on Homer's lips. Men want to control everything, Candy thought. Homer Wells was in the Applemart office. In the mail there was a letter for him from Dr. Larch, but Homer didn't look through the mail. That was Wally's job. Besides, the picking crew had arrived. The harvest would be starting as soon as Homer could get it organized. He looked out the window and saw that his son was not wearing any shirt and talking to Big Dot Taft. He opened the screen door and hollered at Angel. "Hey, it's cold this morning. Put on a shirt." Angel was already walking toward the barns beyond the Apple Mart. "I gotta warm up the tractor," he told his father. "Warm yourself up first," Homer told him, but the boy was already very warm this morning. "Edith?" Angel asked himself. "Ernestine? Esmeralda?" "Eve," he thought. He bumped into Vernon Lynch, who was glowering over a cup of hot coffee. "Watch where you're going," Vernon told Angel.
"'Faith,' Angel said to him. "'Felicia, Francesca, Frederica.'
"'Asshole,' said Vernon Lynch.
"'No, that's you,' Big Dot Taft told him. "'You're the asshole, Vernon.'
"'God, I love the harvest,' Wally said, cruising around the kitchen table while Candy washed the dishes. "'It's my favorite time.'
"'Mine, too,' Candy said, smiling. What she thought was, "'I have 6 more weeks to live.'
Black Pan, the cook, was back. Candy had to hurry. She had to take Black Pan shopping. A man named Peaches had picked for them before, but not for several years. He was called Peaches because his beard never grew. Also, a man named Muddy was back. No one had seen Muddy for years. He'd been badly knifed at the cider house one night, and Homer had driven him to the hospital in Cape Kenneth. Muddy had taken 123 stitches. Homer Wells thought he'd look like a kind of experimental sausage. The man who'd cut him was long gone. That was one of Mr. Rose's rules. Homer guessed it might have been the dominant rule of the cider house. No hurting each other. You cut people to scare them, to show them who's boss, but you don't send people to the hospital. Then the law comes, and everyone at the cider house feels small. The man who'd cut Muddy hadn't been thinking about the community.
"He was really trying to cut my ass off, man," Muddy had said, as if he were surprised.
"He was an amateur," Mr. Rose had said. "He long gone now, anyway."
The rest of the crew, except for Mr. Rose's daughter, hadn't been to Ocean View before. Mr. Rose arranged with Angel how Rose Rose and her daughter would spend the day.
"She gonna ride around with you and help you out," Mr. Rose told Angel.
"She can sit on the fender or stand behind the seat. She can ride on the trailer before it full."
"Sure," Angel said.
"If she need to take the baby back to the cider house, she can walk," Mr. Rose said. "She don't need no special favors."
"No," Angel said. It surprised him that Mr. Rose would speak this way about his daughter when she was standing beside him, looking a little embarrassed. Baby Rose, pacifier in place, rode her hip.
"Sometimes Black Pan can look after the baby," Mr. Rose said, and Rose Rose nodded.
"Candy said she'd look after her, too," Angel offered.
"No need botherin' Mrs. Worthington," said Mr. Rose, and Rose Rose shook her head.
When Angel drove the tractor, he always stood up. If he sat down without a cushion on the seat, and he thought a cushion was for an old man with piles, he couldn't quite see the radiator cap. He was afraid that if he sat down, the engine might overheat and the radiator would boil over without his noticing it. But most of all, it looked better to drive a tractor standing up. He was glad he was driving the International Harvester. Years ago, Raymond Kendall had built a swivel for the seat. He could let Rose Rose sit down, with or without Baby Rose in her lap, and he could stand a little to one side of the swivel seat and operate the tractor without awkwardness. There was a foot clutch, a foot brake, and a hand throttle. The emergency hand brake was next to Rose Rose's hip. The gear shift was by her knee.
"Why you wear that old baseball cap?" she asked him. "You got nice eyes, but nobody see 'em. You got nice hair, but nobody see it. And you got one pale forehead 'cause the sun can't find your face. If you didn't wear that dumb cap, your face would be as brown as your body."
This implied to Angel, of course, that Rose Rose liked his body being brown, didn't care for his forehead being pale, and had managed, despite the hat, to notice his eyes and hair, and to like them, too. After filling the trailer with his first load of apples, Angel took a long drink from a water jug in the orchard, twisting the baseball cap backward on his head as he drank. Then he wore it that way, the way a catcher wears a baseball cap, or the way Candy wore it, with the visor tipped over her hair and the back of her neck. Somehow it looked better that way on Candy. When Rose Rose saw Angel wearing the cap that way, she said, "Now you look real stupid. Look like you got a ball for your head." The next day, Angel let Candy wear the cap. Baby Rose was sucking the pacifier like a 3-horsepower pump, and Rose Rose smiled at Angel. "Where's that nice hat?" she asked him.
"I lost it," he lied.
"Too bad," she said. "It was nice."
"I thought you didn't like that hat," he said.
"I didn't like that hat on you," Rose Rose said.
The next day he brought the hat and put it on her head as soon as she was settled into the tractor seat. Rose looked awfully pleased. She wore the hat the same way Angel had worn it, low over her eyes. Baby Rose looked cross-eyed at the visor.
"You lost it and then you found it, huh?" Rose asked Angel.
"Right," Angel said.
"You better be careful," she told him. "You don't want to get involved with me."
But Angel was flattered and encouraged that she'd even noticed his interest, especially since he was unsure how to express his interest.
"How old are you?" he asked her casually later that day.
"About your age, Angel," was all she said. Baby Rose slumped against her breast. A floppy-brimmed white sailor's hat protected the baby from the sun. But under the brim of the hat, the little girl looked glassy-eyed and exhausted from chomping on the pacifier all day.
"I don't believe you can still be teething," Rose said to her daughter. She took hold of the baby blue plastic ring and pulled the pacifier out of the little girl's mouth. It made a pop like a wine cork, which startled Baby Rose.
"You becoming an addict," Rose said, but when Baby Rose started to cry, her mother put the nipple back.
"How do you like the name Gabriella?" Angel asked Rose.
"I never heard it before," she said.
"How about ginger?" Angel asked.
"That's something you eat," Rose said.
"Gloria?" Angel asked.
"That's nice," said Rose. "Who it for?"
"Your baby," Angel said. "I've been thinking up names for your baby."
Rose raised the visor of the Boston Red Sox cap and looked into Angel's eyes.
"Why are you thinking of that?" she asked him.
"Just to be of help," he said awkwardly.
"Just to help you decide."
"Decide?" Rose asked.
"To help you make up your mind," said Angel Wells.
The picker named Peaches was almost as fast as Mr. Rose. He was emptying his canvas bag into a bushel crate, and he interrupted Rose and Angel.
"You counting me, Angel?" Peaches asked.
"I got you," Angel said. Sometimes Angel examined the fruit if he didn't know the picker very well, to make sure they weren't bruising it. If they were bruising it, or if there were other signs that they were picking too fast, Angel wouldn't give them the top price for a bushel. But Angel knew Peaches was a good picker, so he just put a number on the list without getting off the tractor to look at the apples.
"Ain't you a checker?" Peaches asked Angel then.
"Sure, I got you," Angel said to him.
"Don't you want to check me, then? Better make sure I ain't picking pears or something," Peaches said, grinning.
Angel went to look over the apples, and that was when Peaches said to him,
"You don't want to go into the knife business with Mr. Rose."
Then he walked away with his bag and his ladder before Angel could say anything about his apples, which were, of course, perfect. Back on the tractor, Angel got up his nerve.
"Are you still married to the baby's father?" he asked Rose.
"Was never married," she said. "Are you still together, you and the father?" Angel asked.
"Baby got no father," Rose said. "I was never together."
"I like Hazel and Heather," Angel said after a while. "They're both names of plants, so they sort of go with Rose."
"I don't have no plant. I got a little girl," Rose said, smiling.
"I also like the name Hope," Angel said.
"Hope ain't no name," Rose said.
"Iris is nice," Angel said, "but it's sort of cute because it's another flower. Then there's Isadora."
"Phew," said Rose. "No name is better than some."
"Well, how about plain old Jane?" asked Angel Wells, who was getting frustrated. "Jennifer, Jessica, Jewel, Joyce, Jill, Julia, Justine?" She touched him. She just put her hand on his hip, which nearly caused him to jackknife the trailer and spill the load.
"Don't never stop," she told him. "I never knew there were so many names. Go on," she said, her hand urging him.
It was just a little shove before she returned her hand to her lap, where Baby Rose sat mesmerized by the tractor's motion and the tractor's sound.
"Catherine, Kathleen, Kirsten, Kitty," Angel Wells began.
"Go on," Rose said, her hand grazing his hip again.
"Laura, Lori, Laverne, Lavinia, Leah,
That means weary, he told her. Leslie, Libby, Loretta, Lucy, Mabel, that means lovable, he told her. Malvina, that means smooth snow, he explained.
I never live in where they got snow, Rose said.
Maria, Angel said. Marigold, that's another flower. Mavis, that means a thrush. It's a kind of bird, he said.
Don't tell me what they mean, Rose instructed him.
Melissa, Mercedes, Angel said. Ain't that a car? Rose asked him.
It's a good car, Angel said. A German car, very expensive.
I seen one, I think, Rose said. They got a funny bullseye on the hood.
They're insignia, said Angel Wells.
They're what? She asked.
It's a kind of bullseye, you're right, Angel said.
Say it again, Rose said.
Mercedes, he said.
It's for rich people, ain't it? Rose asked.
The car? He asked.
The name or the car, she said.
Well, Angel said, it's an expensive car, but the name means Our Lady of Mercies.
Well, fuck it then, Rose said. Didn't I tell you not to tell me what the names mean?
Sorry, he said.
How come you never wear a shirt? She asked him. Ain't you never cold?
Angel shrugged.
You can go on with them names any time, she told him.
After the first 4 or 5 days of the harvest, the wind shifted. There was a strong sea breeze off the Atlantic, and the early mornings were especially cold. Angel wore a T-shirt and a sweatshirt over that. One morning, when it was so cold that Rose had left Baby Rose with Candy, Angel saw that she was shivering, and he gave her his sweatshirt. She wore it all day. She was still wearing it when Angel went to help with the cider press that night, and for a while they sat on the cider house roof together. Black Pan sat up there with them, and he told them about the time when there'd been an army installation on the coast, which they could see at night.
"It was a secret weapon," he told them. "And your father," Black Pan told Angel, "he made up a name for it. He had us all shit in our pants, we were so scared. It was a kind of wheel, he told us. It sent people to the moon or something."
"It was a Ferris wheel," said Mr. Rose in the darkness. "It was just a Ferris wheel."
"Yeah, that what it was," Black Pan said. "I seen one once."
"But it was something else that used to be out there," Mr. Rose said dreamily. "It got used in the war."
"Yeah," Black Pan said, "they shot it at somebody."
Watching the lights on the coast, Rose announced, "I'm moving to the city."
"Maybe, when you old enough," said Mr. Rose.
"Maybe Atlanta," she said. "I've been in Atlanta," she told Angel, "at night, too."
"That was Charleston," Mr. Rose said, "unless you was in Atlanta some other time."
"You said it was Atlanta," she told him.
"Maybe I said it was Atlanta," said Mr. Rose, "but it was Charleston."
Black Pan laughed. Rose forgot to give the sweatshirt back, but in the morning, when it was still cold, she was wearing one of Mr. Rose's old sweaters, and she handed the sweatshirt back to Angel. "Got my own clothes sort of this morning," she told Angel, the baseball cap pulled lower than usual over her eyes. Black Pan was watching after Baby Rose, and it took Angel a while to see that Rose had a black eye. A white person doesn't spot a black eye on a black person right away, but she had a good one.
"He said it okay if I wear your hat, but for you to wear your own shirt," Rose told Angel.
"I told you," she said, "you don't want to get involved with me." After the picking that day, Angel went to the cider house to have a word with Mr. Rose. Angel told Mr. Rose that he meant nothing improper by letting Rose wear his sweatshirt. Angel added that he really liked Mr. Rose's daughter, and so forth. Angel got pretty worked up about it, although Mr. Rose remained a calm, calm man. Of course, Angel, and all the rest of them, had seen Mr. Rose peel and core an apple in about 3 or 4 seconds. It was widely presumed that Mr. Rose could bleed a man in half a minute. He could have made the whole mess of a human being look like a series of slight shaving injuries.
"Who told you I beat my daughter, Angel?" Mr. Rose asked gently.
Rose had told Angel, of course, but now Angel saw the trap. He was only making trouble for her.
Mr. Rose would never allow himself to have any trouble with Angel. Mr. Rose knew the rules. They were the real cider house rules. They were the picker's rules.
"I just thought you had hit her," Angel said, backing off.
"Not me," said Mr. Rose. Before he put the tractor away, Angel spoke with Rose Rose. He told her that if she was frightened about staying in the cider house, she could always stay with him, that he had an extra bed in his room, or that he could vacate his room and make it into a guest room for her and her baby.
"A guest room?" Rose Rose said.
She laughed. She told him he was the nicest man she ever knew. She had such a languid manner, like someone who was used to sleeping while standing up, her heavy limbs as relaxed as if she were underwater. She had a lazy body, yet in her presence Angel felt the same potential for lightning-quick movement that surrounded her father as intimately as someone's scent. Rose Rose gave Angel the shivers. At supper, his father asked him, "How are you getting along with Mr. Rose?"
"I'm more curious how you're getting along with Rose Rose," Candy said.
"How he's getting along with the girl is his own business," Wally said.
"Right," said Homer Wells, and Wally let it pass.
"How you're getting along with Mr. Rose is our business, Angel," Wally said.
"Because we love you," Homer said.
"Mr. Rose won't hurt me," Angel told them.
"Of course he won't," Candy said.
"Mr. Rose does what he wants," Wally said. "He's got his own rules," said Homer Wells.
"He beats his daughter," Angel told them. "He hit her once, anyway."
"Don't make that your business, Angel," Wally told the boy.
"That's right," Homer said.
"I'll make it my business," Candy told them. "If he's beating that girl, he'll hear about it from me."
"No, he won't," Wally said.
"Better not," Homer told her.
"Don't tell me what to do," she told them,
and they were quiet. They both knew better than to try to tell Candy what to do.
"Are you sure it's true, Angel?" Candy asked.
"Almost sure," the boy said. 99%.
"Make it 100%, Angel, before you say it's true," his father told him.
"Right," Angel said as he got up from the table and cleared his dishes.
"Good thing we got all that straightened out," Wally said when Angel was in the kitchen.
"Good thing we're all such experts at the truth," he said as Candy got up from the table to clear her dishes. Homer Wells kept sitting where he was. The next morning, Angel learned that Rose Rose had never been in the ocean, that she'd picked citrus in Florida and peaches in Georgia, and she'd driven up the East Coast all the way to Maine, but she'd never stuck so much as her toe in the Atlantic. She'd never even felt the sand.
"That's crazy," said Angel Wells. "We'll go to the beach some Sunday."
"What for?" she said. "You think I'm going to look better with a tan? What would I go to a beach for?"
"To swim," Angel said. "The ocean, the salt water."
"I don't know how to swim," Rose Rose informed him.
"Oh," he said.
"Well, you don't have to swim to enjoy the ocean. You don't have to go in over your head."
"I don't have no bathing suit," she said.
"Oh," Angel said. "Well, I can get you one. I'll bet one of Candy's would fit you."
Rose Rose looked only mildly surprised. Any bathing suit of Candy's would be a tight fit. For their lunch break, after Rose Rose had seen how Baby Rose was getting along with Black Pan, Angel drove her to the baby tree orchard near Cock Hill. They were not picking the baby trees, so there was no one there. You could barely see the ocean. You could see the unnatural end of the horizon, how the sky inexplicably flattened out, and by standing on the tractor they could distinguish the different tones of blue and gray where the sky bled into the sea. Rose Rose remained unimpressed.
"Come on," Angel said to her. "You gotta let me take you to see it."
He tugged her by one arm, just fooling around, just an affectionate gesture. But suddenly she cried out. His hand grazed the small of her back as she turned away from him, and when he looked at his hand he saw her blood.
"It's my period," she lied.
Even a 15-year-old boy knows that the blood from anyone's period isn't usually found on the back. After they kissed for a while, she showed him some of the wounds, not the ones on the backs of her legs, and not the ones on her rump. He had to take her word for those. She showed him only the cuts on her back. They were fine, thread-thin, razor-like cuts. They were extremely deliberate, very careful cuts that would heal completely in a day or two. They were slightly deeper than scratches. They were not intended to leave scars. "I told you," she said to Angel, but she still kissed him, hard. "You shouldn't have no business with me. I ain't really available." Angel agreed not to bring up the matter of the cuts with Mr. Rose. That would only make things worse. Rose convinced him of that. And if Angel wanted to take her to the beach, somehow, some Sunday, they should both be as nice to Mr. Rose as they could manage. The man named Muddy, who'd been reassembled with 123 stitches, had said it best. What he said once was, "If old Rose had cut me, I wouldn't have needed one stitch. I would have bled a pint an hour, or even slower, and when it was finally all over, it would have looked like somebody hadn't used anything on me except a stiff toothbrush." When Angel was putting the tractor away on Saturday, it was Muddy instead of Peaches who spoke to him. "You don't want to get involved with Rose, you know. The knife business ain't your business, Angel," Muddy said, putting his arm around the boy and giving him a squeeze. Muddy liked Angel. He remembered fondly how Angel's father had gotten him to Cape Kenneth Hospital in time. When there was another night pressing, Angel sat with Rose on the cider house roof and told her all about the ocean, the strange tiredness one feels at the edge of the sea, the weight in the air, the haze in the middle of a summer day, the way the surf softens sharp things. He told her the whole familiar story, how we love to love things for other people, how we love to have other people love things through our eyes. But Angel could not keep secret what he imagined was the enormity of Mr. Rose's wrongdoing. He told the whole story to his father and to Candy and Wally. "He cut her? He deliberately cut her?" Wally asked Angel. "No doubt about it," Angel said. "I'm 100% sure." "I can't imagine how he could do that to his own daughter," said Homer Wells. "I can't believe how we're always saying how wonderful it is that Mr. Rose is so in charge of everything," Candy said, shivering. "We have to do something about this."
"We do?" Wally asked.
"Well, we can't do nothing," Candy told him.
"People do," Wally said.
"If you speak to him, he'll hurt her more," Angel told them, "and she'll know I told you. I want your advice. I don't want you to do anything."
"I wasn't thinking of speaking to him," Candy said angrily. "I was thinking of speaking to the police. You can't carve up your own children."
"But will it help her if he gets in trouble?" Homer asked.
"Precisely," Wally said. "We're not helping her by going to the police."
"Or by speaking to him," Angel said.
"There's always waiting and seeing," said Homer Wells.
For 15 years, Candy had learned to ignore this.
"I could ask her to stay with us," Angel suggested. "That would get her away from him. I mean, she could just stay here even after the harvest."
"But what would she do?" Candy asked.
"There aren't any jobs around," said Homer Wells, "not after the harvest."
"It's one thing having them pick," Wally said carefully. "I mean, everyone accepts them, but they're only migrants. They're transients. They're supposed to move on. I don't think that a colored woman with an illegitimate child is going to be made to feel all that welcome in Maine, not if she's staying."
Candy was cross. She said, "Wally, in all the years I've been here, I've never heard anyone call them niggers or say anything bad about them. This isn't the South," she added proudly.
"Come on," Wally said. "It only isn't the South because they don't live here. Let one of them actually try to live here and see what they call her."
"I don't believe that," Candy said.
"Then you're dumb," Wally said. "Isn't she, old boy?" Wally asked Homer. But Homer Wells was watching Angel.
"Are you in love with Rose, Angel?" Homer asked his son.
"Yes," Angel said, "and I think she likes me, at least a little."
He cleared his own dishes and went upstairs to his room.
"He's in love with the girl," Homer said to Candy and Wally.
"As plain as the nose on your face, old boy," Wally said. "Where have you been?"
He wheeled himself out on the terrace and took a few turns around the swimming pool.
"What do you think of that?" Homer asked Candy.
"Angel's in love."
"I hope it makes him more sympathetic to us," Candy told him. "That's what I think about it."
But Homer Wells was thinking about Mr. Rose. How far would he go? What were his rules? When Wally wheeled himself back into the house, he told Homer that there was some mail for him in the Apple Mart office.
"I kept meaning to bring it to the house," Wally told him, "but I keep forgetting it."
Just keep forgetting it, Homer advised him. It's the harvest. Since I don't have time to answer any mail, I might as well not read it. Nurse Caroline's letter had also arrived. It was waiting for him with Dr. Larch's letter, and with a letter from Melanie. Melanie had returned the questionnaire to Homer. She hadn't filled it out. She'd just been curious, and she'd wanted to look it over more closely. After she'd read it a few times, she could tell, by the nature of the questions, that the Board of Trustees were, in her opinion, a collection of the usual assholes. "The guys in suits," she called them. "Don't you hate men in suits?" she'd asked Lorna. "Come on," Lorna had told her, "you just hate men, all men." "Men in suits especially," Melanie had said. Across the questionnaire, which would never be filled out, Melanie had written a brief message to Homer Wells. "Dear Sunshine, I thought you was going to be a hero. My mistake. Sorry for a hard time. Love, Melanie." Homer Wells would read that much later that same night when he couldn't sleep, as usual, and he decided to get up and read his mail. He would read Dr. Larch's letter and Nurse Caroline's, too, and any doubts that were remaining about the doctor's bag with the initials F.S. engraved in gold had disappeared with the darkness just before dawn. Homer saw no reason to add irony to their predicament. He decided not to send Melanie's response to the questionnaire to Larch or to Nurse Caroline. How would it help them to know that they had turned themselves in when they might have gone on for another few years? He sent a single short note, addressed to them both. The note was simple and mathematical. 1. I am not a doctor. 2. I believe the fetus has a soul. 3. I'm sorry. "Sorry," said Wilbur Larch when Nurse Caroline read him the note. "He says he's sorry?" "Of course he isn't a doctor," Nurse Angela admitted. "There'd always be something he'd think he didn't know. He'd always be thinking he was going to make an amateur mistake." "That's why he'd be a good doctor," said Dr. Larch. "Doctors who think they know everything are the ones who make the most amateur mistakes. That's how a good doctor should be thinking, that there's always something he doesn't know, that he can always kill someone." "We're in for it now," Nurse Edna said. "He believes the fetus has a soul, does he?" Larch asked. "Fine. He believes that a creature that lives like a fish has a soul. And what sort of soul does he believe those of us walking around have? He should believe in what he can see. If he's going to play God and tell us who's got a soul, he should take care of the souls who can talk back to him." He was ranting. Then Nurse Angela said, "So, we wait and see." "Not me," said Wilbur Larch. "Homer can wait and see," he said, "but not me." He sat at the typewriter in Nurse Angela's office. He wrote this simple mathematical note to Homer Wells. 1. You know everything I know, plus what you've taught yourself. You're a better doctor than I am, and you know it. 2. You think what I do is playing God, but you presume you know what God wants. Do you think that's not playing God? 3. I am not sorry, not for anything I've done. One abortion I did not perform is the only one I'm sorry for. I'm not even sorry that I love you. Then Dr. Larch walked to the railroad station and waited for the train. He wanted to see the note sent on its way. Later, the station master, whom Larch rarely acknowledged, admitted he was surprised that Larch spoke to him. But because Larch spoke after the train had gone, the station master thought that Larch might have been addressing the departed train. "Goodbye," Dr. Larch said. He walked back up the hill to the orphanage. Mrs. Grogan asked him if he wanted some tea, but Dr. Larch told her that he felt too tired for tea. He wanted to lie down. Nurse Caroline and Nurse Edna were picking apples, and Larch went a little way up the hill to speak to them. "You're too old to pick apples, Edna," Larch told her. "Let Caroline and the children do it." He then walked a short distance with Nurse Caroline back toward the orphanage. "If I had to be anything," he told her, "I'd probably be a socialist, but I don't want to be anything." Then he went into the dispensary and closed the door. Despite the harvest weather, it was still warm enough to have the window open during the day.
He closed the window, too. It was a new full can of ether. Perhaps he jabbed the safety pin too roughly into the can, or else he wiggled it around too impatiently.